Strong Gravity. So I'm Will East. I'll be lecturing for the next 5 weeks. So in this class, we're going to explore some aspects of black holes, gravitational waves, and other features of Einstein's theory of general relativity. In particular, we're going to sort of develop the tools to understand gravity in the regime where space-time is strongly curved and things can be highly dynamical. All right, before we get into physics, like a couple words on logistics. So we'll have lectures for the next 5 weeks. A couple weeks in, we'll have a couple guest lectures by Louise Lehner, so you guys get to hear from the other faculty at PI. We're also working on strong gravity. We have a relatively small class, so please feel free to ask lots of questions. Can't understand me through my mask, tell me to speak up. If I write something wrong on the board, please correct me. So there's going to be 6 tutorials for this class. And the first one will be on Monday afternoon. So you should take a look at the tutorial handout before you come. And if you can't make it, then you should let Giuseppe, who'll be the TA, or sorry, the PI fellow, or the TA, who'll be Max Corman, know ahead of time. So just to emphasize, this class is not a numerical GR class. We're going to be sort of developing analytic and mathematical tools that you need to understand strong gravity, sort of all its aspects, whether it be mathematical, although these tools will also be useful for numerical GR. We're not going to talk about numerical methods in this class, and sort of the problem sets will be pen and paper. But for a couple of the tutorials, there will be some sort of lightweight numerical stuff at the level of integrating ordinary differential equations and making plots, which hopefully everyone knows how to do, you know, whether it be with Mathematica or MATLAB, or if you're feeling patriotic, Maple or SciPy, NumPy. So just by a show of hands, does everyone know how to use one of those programs or some other program that can integrate ordinary differential equations? Great. If you don't, or you need a refresher, then it might be good to take a look at that or talk to the TA or my fellow before the first tutorial. And there'll also be 2 problem sets for the class. Any questions about logistics?
So the problem sets will also be mostly pen and paper.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into physics. So one thing I'm going to sort of emphasize in this class is that, you know, with the recent detections of gravitational waves from merging black holes and neutron stars made by LIGO, Virgo, and even more detectors being built and coming online soon, you know, we've really entered into this new era of physics where we can actually see the dynamics of space-time. And so this course will sort of develop the theoretical tools and concepts to understand dynamical space-time. And it'll be, you know, these are tools that are relevant and important for numerous sort of subfields of quantum gravity, including, you know, performing simulations of merging black holes, or, you know, using the ADS-CFT correspondence to study things in the nonlinear regime, or looking at the dynamics of very inhomogeneous cosmologies in the early universe. We're going to start a little bit slow at the beginning, just looking at the dynamics happening on the background of a black hole spacetime. We're considering black hole spacetimes that change very slowly. But then after those lectures, we'll get more into talking about how to formulate Einstein's equations as a sort of a set of evolution equations. We can say, I start with some initial conditions, and then the Einstein equations actually tell me what happens in the future, which is, you know, normally how we think of most physical theories, as theories that tell us we start with some initial conditions, what happens later. we'll also talk about how to define things like what does it mean to have a black hole in a dynamical setting. And of course, we'll also talk about gravitational waves, how they're sourced and how they propagate. So just to start out at the very beginning, so I'm assuming everyone here has had an introductory GR course. So I'm just going to give a very lightning review of sort of introductory general relativity, also to sort of fix the conventions that we'll be using this class. So now that we're sort of...
Sorry, quick question. Are we going to have lecture notes? Are you going to upload them?
I wasn't planning to, but if that's useful, I could...
Thank you.
Yeah, I could do that. So since we're sort of advanced general relativists, we're going to use geometric units in this class. So that's where we're going to set g and c to 1, since we don't have time to write them down every time. For our index conventions, so I'm going to use the initial letters of the alphabet, A, B, C, D, and so on, to index four-dimensional indices. That's space-time indices. And I, J, K, and so on, to index three-dimensional indices. That is spatial ones. So for example, a four vector be written with A, and then have a time component, and then three spatial components. So for a metric signature, we're going to use the so-called East Coast metric signature. Also known as the mostly plus one. Since we're on the East Coast, and also because this is just the right one to use. For the metric, we'll write that as GAB. So we want the proper space-time length. It's related to the metric like so, the proper length squared. And then we can use the metric to construct the Christoffel symbols. So those are related to first derivatives of the metric as follows. So notice that the Christoffel symbols are symmetric in these indices. So if we switch A and B, then we these two guys switch, and then this one remains the same. And we can use these Christoffel symbols to define the covariant derivative. So just to define that on sort of an arbitrary tensor, it can have upstairs indices or downstairs indices. And we have an ordinary derivative and then the rule is we have to contract with the Christoffel symbols. for each indice. And we have a plus sign for upstairs indices. And then when we contract with the downstairs indices, we get a minus sign. Okay. That's buffle symbols. Okay. So as you may recall, the metric is so-called compatible with this covariant derivative. And what that means is that if we take the covariant derivative of the metric, we just get zero. And so now we're ready to define the Riemann tensor. So the Riemann tensor can basically be defined as the commutator of these covariant derivatives. So what happens if you reverse the order when you apply this to a vector? And so in general, on a curved manifold, you won't get zero. And what you do get for an arbitrary vector is this is the definition of the Riemann tensor. And you know, you can work out what that is using the definition of the covariant derivative in terms of the Christoffel symbols, and then you get the following. That's a little bit complicated, but the main thing to note is that so now the Riemann tensor, so the Christoffel symbols involve first derivatives of the metric. So now the Riemann tensor involves second derivatives of the metric. And with this Riemann tensor defined, then we can just use it to define several other useful quantities, including the Ricci tensor. We just get by contracting two of the indices of the Riemann tensor. And then we can keep contracting and define the Ricci scalar. And finally, we can define the Einstein tensor. And with all those definitions, now it's very easy to write down the Einstein equations. Which is just that the Einstein tensor is equal to 8 pi times the stress energy tensor. So this sort of encodes all the matter and stresses. or energy sources. So for example, you know, there are many different forms this can take, considering like depending on what kind of matter you're considering to gravitate. But for example, a common one is the perfect fluid stress energy tensor. So here, rho is the energy density of the fluid, d is the pressure, u is the four velocity of the fluid, and again, this p is the pressure, and that's the metric. And so these energy densities or pressures are what you would see in a frame where you're co-moving the fluid, i.e., you have your four velocities the same as the fluids. And any stress energy tensor should satisfy stress energy conservation. And what that means mathematically is that this divergence of the stress energy tensor is zero. So this should be sort of independently satisfied by the matter, but in fact, it doesn't really make sense to couple some stress energy tensor through the Einstein equations that isn't conserved, because we can apply this covariant derivative to both sides, and the left hand side is actually going to be a zero just by one of the Bianchi identities, if you recall. But that means this side better be zero too. You can also see from these equations that, we're really not imposing, if we allow ourselves to consider any kind of matter, then we're not really imposing any condition on what space-time manifolds are physically allowed. For example, you could just write down any metric you like, no matter how crazy, just calculate its Einstein tensor, divide by 8 pi and say that's the matter of my system, and it'll technically be a solution to the Einstein equations. You need to impose some conditions on the stress energy tensor. One condition that we'll talk about in this class is the so-called null energy condition. These various conditions basically encapsulate some idea of the energy being positive. So this one basically requires that this quantity be positive for any vector k that's future pointing and null. And if we do the example for this case, that means that we just require this quantity to be greater than or equal to zero. And of course, that's by construction, this will be positive definite. So it's basically that the energy density plus the pressure is positive, so it's not that stringent a condition on the sort of the positivity of the stress energy tensor. For example, we could independently require both these to be positive, and that'd be a stronger condition. Yeah. So that was sort of all of introductory GR. In 5 minutes. So any questions about that before we move on? Okay, so for the next several lectures, we're going to focus on the Kerr black hole solution, which describes an isolated rotating black hole. And we're going to sort of study that solution and the dynamics that can happen on that spacetime. And so you might ask yourself, you know, what's so special about it, the Kerr solution? You know, why do we want to spend, you know, several lectures discussing it? And to answer that question, let me read you a great quote from Chandrasekhar, who's one of the pioneers of relativity. The quote goes, "In my entire scientific life, extending over 45 years, the most shattering experience has been the realization that an exact solution of Einstein's equations of general relativity, discovered by the New Zealand mathematician Roy Kerr, provides the absolute exact representation of untold numbers of massive black holes that populate the universe." So what exactly did Chandrasekhar mean by that? So it turns out that Kerr solutions have a number of properties that sort of make them so special. So first property is that they're the only possible stationary vacuum solution, black hole solution. And this is work due in sort of the late 60s and 70s to Israel, Carter, Hawking, and Robinson. Another important property is that if you consider perturbations of the Kerr solution, they actually decay quite fast. So we'll discuss this more when we discuss so-called quasi-normal modes of black holes later. But in particular, if you perturb a Kerr black hole, that perturbation will die exponentially, and the time scale over which it exponentially decays is approximately just the light crossing time of the black hole radius. And finally, it's conjectured that the final state of generic collapse if you have any sort of matter, you know, it doesn't matter what kind it is. There's a conjecture, and like all great conjectures, it's due to Penrose, and that the final state of generic collapse is going to be a black hole, and it's going to be parameterized by two numbers. The mass and the angular momentum. And you just have this black hole, and then you might also have some outgoing gravitational waves. And you notice I didn't mention electric charge. So black holes can also have electric charge or be charged under some other field. And that's because sort of for most astrophysically relevant scenarios, the charge is thought to be very small. But the statement that you know, a black hole can be parameterized by just a handful of numbers is also sometimes called the no hair theorem. Okay, so let's begin by writing down the metric for a Kerr solution. We're going to write down the metric in so-called Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. All right, so we look at the line element as the following form. All right, and so now I need to define a couple extra quantities here. So we have sigma, which is just r squared plus a squared cosine squared theta. And then we have delta, which is r squared plus a squared minus 2 and times r. So of course, m is the mass of the black hole. And then this a parameter is the angular momentum of the black hole divided by the mass of the black hole. And then sometimes I also use this, we call it a bar, which will be just the angular momentum divided by the mass squared. So that's dimensionless. And I should note that this notation is not universal. Sometimes people use A for the dimensionless quantity. Sometimes people use a chi for it instead. So let's consider a couple different limits of this error solution.
In the I term, is that a delta or?
D phi term.
D phi term.
Sum squared plus r squared.
This is r squared plus a.
Okay.
sorry, was that messy? R squared plus a squared minus delta.
Thank you.
All good. All right. Yeah, so first, let's consider what happens if we just let the angular momentum go to 0. A equals 0. Then we just get the Schwarzschild solution. Which hopefully you've seen before. Now let's consider what happens if we fix the dimensionless spin, but then we let the mass go to 0. Okay, then we stare up here and get the following. All right, so anybody want to take a guess what metric that is? So this is actually this turns out to just be flat space or Minkowski, but it's in some funny coordinates. So we can do a coordinate transformation. Can everybody see if I write here? Yeah, so here, phi is the polar angle. Theta is the polar angle, phi is the azimuthal angle. So notice that if A were 0, this would just be the usual spherical coordinate transformation to Cartesian. Instead with this extra factor of A, R equals 0 actually gets mapped to this ring where x squared plus y squared equals a squared. So these are known as like ellipsoidal coordinates. So you can check that if you just plug in this coordinate transformation, then you get the usual flat Minkowski space in Cartesian coordinates. All right, so our solution that I've written down actually has several symmetries. And associated with each of those symmetries, we can write down a killing vector. So just to remind you, we say that a vector k is killing if when we take the Lie derivative with respect to k of the metric, we get 0. And to remind you what the Lie derivative is, or if you haven't seen it before, so the Lie derivative is sort of an arbitrary tensor would be given by the following. So that's one way of writing it with ordinary derivatives. But we can actually just take the same expression and let all the ordinary derivatives go to covariant derivatives. And then the formula will still hold. In general, covariant and ordinary derivatives are not the same. But actually, all the difference given by the Christoffel symbols will cancel out when you put them in here. That means in particular for the metric, we can let this term go to 0. Does anyone remember why we can let this one go to 0? Replace this by this, the covariant derivative.
It's metric compatible.
Yeah, exactly, because of metric compatibility. And so then we just get this term and this term, or we can even write it as the this symmetrized expression. So that, so basically, if this expression holds for some vector k, then that vector is a Killing vector. So we can note that this Kerr metric that I wrote down, if we look at all the that all the metric coefficients are actually independent of time t, yeah, and phi, the azimuthal coordinate, exactly. That means we're going to have two Killing vectors. So just one pointing in the phi direction. And so that one physically is associated with the solution being axisymmetric. You can, you know, rotate it in the phi direction and get the same solution. And then another one, which is just given by derivative in the time direction. And that's associated with the solution being stationary. So our solution turns out to be stationary, but it's actually not static. And so you can see that by letting t go to minus t. So if we take a look, because of this dt d phi term here, if we let that dt go to minus dt, we pick up a minus sign, we don't get the same solution. But we can see it's kind of equivalent to letting that a go to minus a. So we get a black hole spinning in the opposite direction. Our solution is stationary, but it's not static. Yeah, and you know, if like me, sometimes you have you get these two terms mixed up. You know, for the stationary, you should think of like a stationary exercise bike. You know, it's going round and round, but it's not going anywhere. It's always kind of at the same state. So the black hole is spinning, but it's always spinning the same way at any given moment in time. Yeah, so it turns out that in addition to these two Killing vectors, the Kerr solution actually has a Killing tensor. And so first to just define what a Killing tensor means. Basically just adding another index to this. So we're not gonna go into any depth about this, but let me just write down that the Killing tensor for Kerr happens to be given by this expression. Where this L and N are two null vectors, which I'm not going to write down. So actually in this class we're going to sort of for simplicity mostly stick to, you know, sort of considering things in the equator of Kerr. And this Killing tensor, for example, guarantees that if you have a geodesic that goes, it's orbiting in the equatorial direction, that it'll remain there. But in general, you know, if you have orbits that are off the equator, they can become quite complicated, and then there's some associated conserved quantities due to this Killing tensor. We'll mention that briefly. A bit later on. So any questions about that?
So in terms of these scaling vectors, means for T and phi, I know that if you want to have a conserved quantity, you can contract the stress energy tensor or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But in terms of the killing tensor, how do we construct the conserved quantity? Which I think C, the Carter constant, comes from this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So how do we construct that?
That's a good question. So maybe we should table that one for next time. But I mean, you're exactly right that given these killing vectors, you can construct conserved quantities, for example, for geodesics. And so we'll talk about the energy and angular momentum, and we can also talk about the Carter constant.
What is L and N in this equation?
Yeah, so those are null vectors, which I didn't write down. Because we're not going to spend that much time on the Carter, this killing tensor of Kerr. Yeah, I mean, if you're interested, I could write them down. But they are, these vectors are null in the sense that. They have zero norm. All right, any more questions? Now let's talk about the horizon of our Kerr black hole. So if we look at the expression we have over here, we can notice that this expression is not going to be defined in two different places. So anybody want to tell us one of them?
Delta is 0 or sigma is 0.
So we have delta and sigma in the denominator. So if those quantities are zero, then that won't be defined. So we at least know that these coordinates break down at those two places. So actually, it turns out this sigma equals zero is an actual physical singularity. You can sort of derive that fact by looking at the so-called Kretschmann scalar. That's what you get when you take the Riemann tensor and contract it with itself. And if you do that, you find that the Kretschmann scalar actually blows up as sigma goes to zero. And so this actually corresponds to sort of a ring-like singularity. So you note that in order for this whole quantity to be zero, we want for example, if we look at when theta equals pi over 2, then we have a ring given by r equals a, and then phi can take any value. And then if we, we can vary theta away from pi over 2, and while this quantity is still negative, we'll still have this region where sigma
something's not right. Yeah, both of them are positive, positive.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
No,
that's true.
No.
I It has this cos square.
Yeah.
But.
And also cosine of p half is 0.
Yeah.
Sorry, say that again.
Cosine of p half, pi half is 0.
Yes, you're right. What did I do wrong?
Actually, you have that ring when theta is equal to 0, right? But when you're looking at upward, it's not a ring.
No, but that doesn't happen. Like, sigma is never 0.
Yeah, sorry. I think you're right.
When r is equal to 0 and theta is equal to pi half, it would be singularity.
Yeah, but this
if you just go upward.
Yeah.
In the center of the black hole, it would be singularity.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. That was wrong. Thank you. So when this is 0, then you have r equals 0. But it still corresponds to a ring, like as we discussed for the ellipsoidal coordinates, that r equals 0 gets mapped to a ring. You can still allow phi to take any value, just like in even in flat space. I think I erased that already. Or no, here it is. Yep, thank you. So this is in contrast to the Schwarzschild solution, which also blows up at r equals 0, but it's at a point instead of at this ring. Right. So in these coordinates, which are axisymmetric, stationary, and where the horizon actually turns out to just be at a constant value of r, we can actually just look at when the surfaces of r equals constant become null. And that happens in the following place. This is the unit norm to, or not the unit norm, but the normal to slices of constant r. We're just taking two of them and contracting with themselves. We want to see when this is equal to 0. So that's just equivalent to GRR and these adapted coordinates being 0. And that turns out to be delta over sigma. So this delta equals 0 actually corresponds to a null surface or a horizon of the black hole.
R is equal to, why do we need r is equal to constant null?
Yeah, so I'm showing that this surface of constant r is a null surface and therefore a horizon. So that's not the most general way to find a black hole horizon, but it works for this in axisymmetric and stationary solution, where the horizon is just a surface of constant r.
So then, and when r is constant, then we are saying dA of r is where
the normal.
Yes. Yeah. So just this is the normal to surface of constant r, right? And so we're just contracting two of them. Or just contracting one with the other to see if it's null or not, right? Yeah. So, sort of outside of the horizon, that would be space-like, and then at the horizon, it becomes null. So we can actually factor. So delta is quadratic in R. We can factor it as 2 roots. And those actually correspond to the inner and outer horizon. So like I was saying, these r equals constant surfaces are actually space-like for r greater than r plus, and they become null at r equals r plus. Then they become time-like in between these two. And so the r equals r plus, the larger root, is actually the event horizon that sort of defines the causal boundary between things that can escape to the future null infinity and things that have to start falling into the black hole, actually the time-like direction. And then, you know, the fact that our metric actually isn't defined when delta equals zero, so at these places, actually turns out to be just a coordinate singularity. There are different coordinates for spinning black holes, for example, so-called Hirschfeld coordinates, where you can actually write the metric in such a way that things are, you know, completely well-defined and regular at the horizon.
Maybe what would be the significance of R minus in that sense, that defining a surface where light cannot escape, or particles cannot escape to infinity in terms of R plus? A horizon in Schwarzschild case is just that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a great question. So just wait maybe 2 minutes, and then we'll draw the sort of the causal diagram for the Kerr black hole and where R plus and R minus are. But great question. Any other question? Yeah, and so one other thing to note is that you know, if our dimensionless spin A is actually, its magnitude is greater than zero, then there are, you know, there are no roots to this equation. So our black hole actually doesn't have a horizon. But since it still has this singularity for sigma equals zero, that actually corresponds to what's called a naked singularity. So singularity without a horizon. So that's thought to be unphysical. There's another conjecture to Penrose that called the cosmic censorship conjecture, which basically says that whenever you have a breakdown in the Einstein equations where the curvature is blowing up, there's reasons to be hidden from faraway observers by a horizon. And you know, it turns out that if you try very hard to create a black hole as spin greater than one, it seems like the Einstein equations actually resist ever letting you form such a thing. So you'll work through one such example of that on the first problem set. All right, so now let's draw the conformal diagram for Kerr. So so the way to read these conformal diagrams is that light travels along 45 degrees, like that. So those are null. You know, and that means curves like this are space-like. You know, and curves like this are time-like. And so this scry minus and scry plus, those correspond to future null infinity and past null infinity. So if you have light rays coming in from infinity, going towards the black hole, they come in like this. And if you have something being emitted from near the black hole and going out to infinity, it'd be like that. I0 is spatial infinity. And so here, R plus is this boundary, is our horizon. So, it's a null surface, like we said, so it's at 45 degrees. And if you have something that has to move along time-like curves, like a person, then once it gets to this point, it has no choice but to fall into the black hole horizon. And then it can never get out to the asymptotic infinity. As you're asking, what does R minus correspond to? So it's another null surface. And again, sort of this surface where once you go past it, then you can no longer enter back into this region. So if you go here, then you'll and that's where the R equals zero singularity is. It's actually possible, same as with Schwarzschild, to glue sort of infinite copies of these diagrams together, so-called maximally extended solution. So if you want, you could put this part here, and you have this is the time reversal of a black hole called a white hole. So you could travel through the into the black hole and come out through the white hole, and so on, ad infinitum. Really, we don't think that sort of any of this stuff inside the black hole interior is physical. The Kerr solution is a very good description for outside the black hole, but there's sort of good reason to believe that in between R plus and R minus, in a physical black hole, you have some other type of singularity.
So here, the region outside the black hole would just be the downtime or something.
Yeah, this would be outside the black hole, this region.
And that whole thing is inside.
Yeah, so once you cross into here, this would correspond to crossing through R plus, and this would correspond to crossing through R minus. Yeah, so I think it's about the end of our lecture. So any other questions?
How do you write with a categorized on your spacetime?
Sorry, what's that?
How do you work having a categorized on the spacetime?
How do you work with a
Cauchy? You wrote the scry minus, but that's not defining the whole history of the spacetime, isn't it?
Think
of things that happen to the right of the surface R equals zero that you have wrote, that's undetermined what happens in that right.
Yes, you're exactly right that if you think of you're propagating information, so if I have some surface here, so let's say I tell you what happens here, and you can use that to determine what happens at this later time. Once you cross through this R minus, then the causal past includes points that would not be specified by these initial conditions. So that's kind of another reason to think of these as unphysical, because basically, like you said, there's you sort of need extra information that's not included in this part of the spacetime.
You only think as physical the things that happen outside of R plus? Or like, is the region between R minus and R plus a good description or not?
Yeah, I mean, so this is kind of an ongoing area of research, but yeah, basically we think that sort of before you'd reach R minus, and so before you'd reach the point where, you know, so here this is still determined by, you know, the stuff that fell into the black hole, right? Once you reach this point, then it's not. So we kind of think that the Kerr solution breaks down somewhere between R plus and R minus.
Why don't you just mention that if you're in the ergosphere or like between two horizons, we're still fine, right? Because the past is kind of like defined by some part of the space time which is outside the horizon, right? But but you mentioned that Kerr space time will actually break down between these two?
Or basically by the time you reach here.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and what would be towards the right of the R is equal to zero line that you drew? Because that here things going by R minus to R is equal to zero would not cross R is equal to zero, right? What is that half diamond on the right?
Yeah, so this is the singularity, but I guess you kind of have a choice when you cross through here whether you hit it or not. Yeah.
My question is that what happens on the right of R in the diagram? Because anything that is passing through R minus will hit R is equal to zero without going to the right.
So, once you counter the singularity, sort of, things break down. So, basically, like this whole part, we shouldn't think of as physical. And yeah, for the rest of the class, we're not going to really discuss it. I mean, another thing I can mention is, you know, if you kind of think of an observer, you know, passing through here, basically all incoming light rays, the whole feature would of the spacetime would be kind of hit that observer as they're crossing this R minus. That's another kind of reason to think that the surface might be unstable or unphysical. Great questions. All right. Any else? Any other ones? All right, well, thank you, and see you tomorrow.